Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast with our special guest, Johnny Enoch. And we're going to take your calls with Johnny as we talk about his research into the extraterrestrial phenomena. And welcome back to Coast with Johnny Enoch. And we'll get your calls as well as we talk about his work in the very strange and unusual. What about heaven and hell, Johnny? What are your take on that?
Well, I would say that we most certainly have a heaven above the earth that people go to. And, you know, it's very interesting. I was talking to a fellow over here in Canada not too long ago that he had some very interesting experiences. His name is Garnet Schulhauser. And he has relayed to me that the name for the heaven above our earth is called Aglaia. And up there, that a lot of our NDEers, the place that our NDEers talk about going to, they have architectonics and architecture very similar to what we have on Earth. They have concerts over there, according to Garnet. He told me that, you know, when he went over to the other side, he saw the Beatles playing a concert with, you know, John Lennon and Ringo Starr. They're playing Yesterday and all these things, halls of records and places we can go. But I would say that from what I've discovered that hell doesn't exist. I believe that it's an artificial construct. It's been made up. It comes back from Dante's Inferno and the nine circles of hell that we get back from the Last Judgment. So, yeah, I think it's real. But the interesting thing, George, when I was talking to Garnet, he told me that all the planets out in our universe have their own sort of heavenly city that's unique to people in different time periods of their planet. But he said they're all sort of connected at the same time.
Interesting take. Now, you've also been to Ireland. I've been talking about leprechauns with Mae McCarthy. I don't know if you know her, but are you convinced that there are little fairies and leprechauns out there?
Absolutely.
Yeah, she absolutely is too. She is too.
I'm very convinced. The search I have done into this has revealed absolute evidence for that. I've gone into these countries, and what I do is I just sort of wing it. I just fly into these countries. I go rent a car, and I bring a video camera with me, and I went to every single city, every single town, every single area, all the pubs, went and found these old Shaughnessys and asked them questions. And when I first got into Ireland, I was getting off the plane, and I asked the taxi driver on the way to Dublin to go get my car. I said, "Do you believe in leprechauns?" And he says, "Well, if you want to see a leprechaun, go drink 12 pints of Guinness, and you'll see one." So I found out very quickly that the people in the big cities, you know, they might not have had, you know, such an open mind. But as soon as I went out into the country, I got very, very lucky. And I went out into the middle of nowhere one day, George, and I went. It was raining outside, and I found this old, rundown castle. It was absolutely incredible, 700-year-old castle, and I met a man named Sean Ryan that was sitting by his crackling fireplace. And as I sat down with him, I had no idea what to expect. I just had all these people in these little towns pointing me to him and say, "If you want to find proof, if you want to see where the fairies are and the leprechauns, talk to this man." So I sat down with him, and he said, "They're absolutely real." And he basically stood up, and he said to me, "You know, I can show you where they are. You're going to have to turn the camera off, but I can show you where they are." And he said, "This is a song I'm going to play for you." And his little flute he played for me that the King of the Fairies taught him. And I soon discovered that people absolutely believe in them. They're terrified of disrupting these fairy rings and fairy forts. And this is in Ireland today. People still believe in the fairies.
And they have powers, don't they?
Absolutely. They're very mischievous. Now, I'll tell you, my investigation into them also is connected to the work I've looked at with extraterrestrials, because I've kind of hypothesized, based on what they've told me, that maybe there's a connection here to, you know, we're told that they fell from the heavens, they fell to Earth, and they found refuge in the subterranean areas with the Tuatha De Danann, who, by the way, came to Ireland on flying ships. And there's a whole connection here to the serpentine mysteries we were talking about earlier, because we know St. Patrick chased the serpents out of Ireland. So there's all kinds of mysticism and legends surrounding them.
Skype is open at George 97313, and let us go to the phones. Brian in Indianapolis, east of the Rockies, to get us started. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Good morning. How are you?
Great, Brian. Thank you.
Hey, Johnny. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you, Brian.
Hey, great subject, man. I'm really been, my wife got me interested in all this ancient alien stuff. I got a couple questions. What do you think that, number one, Tesla, he was probably an alien, I would suspect.
Or a time traveler.
Or a time traveler. That's a good one. But my second question, more importantly, is I'm obsessed with this, three-fingered, three-toed skeleton or mummy that they found down in South America, I believe. George, remember I talked to
Powell
about it?
In Peru,
yes. What do you think? What's your opinion on this, and what do you think will come of it? And I heard there's other ones in these caves that the Peruvian government has blocked off.
There's a whole bunch, and that's where some of the DNA came in, Johnny.
Now, to answer your first question, was Tesla an alien? You know, it's possible. It's possible that he was some sort of a hybridized genetic superhuman mutant never considered for mass production. He was absolutely incredible. What a genius, everything that he gave us. I mean, we're still wrapping our heads around everything that he put out. And I believe, like what I was saying earlier about his breakthroughs into scalar energy and how when we look over what zero-point energy is and free energy, we could start looking over at Tesla. There's some very, very impressive, fascinating things that came out of him. But to answer your question, there are some incredible things in Peru. There's some, from the information I've gotten, there's some things that we're not fully ready to discuss yet. The public isn't ready to discuss. It's under the Nazca lines, the stuff that's in Paracas, all these places. As for the
that's the beginning of Eric von Däniken's book, Chariots of the Gods, right there.
Yeah, there you go. It's a classic. Now, as for the three-fingered mummy, I keep an open mind with all of these things. I know everyone has their opinions. We know that medical doctors have called it a fake. When I was talking to Brian Forrester yesterday, we were talking, he was on a train leaving Cusco with a radiologist friend of his, Ken, and he said that it was his professional opinion that the three fingers on the mummy all come from three different mummies. So I don't think that he's too convinced about it, but I think that as investigators, we have to look at all the possibilities.
Sure. It's got some strange DNA to it.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. And that's why we have to keep an open mind. And I don't think we can just shut the case down so fast, just like the Atamaca being they found over in Chile. Some people are saying, dismissing this is just a small disfigured being. And then we got a paper from Emory Smith coming out that's challenging the narrative. So I think we got to keep a very open mind.
Well, and remember Lloyd Pye's Star Child. I mean, that unfortunately he died and still never got his answers. But that is a strange little skull too.
Yeah, it is. His work was absolutely incredible, and I believe his protege Robert Sepper continued his work looking at all that stuff from an anthropological perspective. There's so many fascinating mysteries out there that need to be looked at. I don't think we should shut the case on any of these.
No, not at all. Next up, let's go to Mary in Jacksonville, Florida. First time caller for us. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I want to thank you for giving a platform to all the subjects that nobody else wants to talk about. I wasn't able to get through earlier with regards to the opioid.
Yes.
In 1987, I spent 28 days in a burn unit, and I was giving very large doses of morphine, methadone, Dilaudid, and Valium. After I was only home for 3 days, and I had to check myself into a chemical dependency hospital.
You're lucky you're still with us, Mary.
I am. I'm grateful for what the doctors and the plastic surgeons did, but at the same time, I left with a drug addiction.
Well, you keep fighting the good fight. Do you have a question for Johnny with his work?
Well, not really. I just wanted to plead with the Coast audience. I have no immune system, and I have no pain tolerance level. Please, please don't ever just say, I'm going to try it. Don't. It's not worth it.
No, it's not. It's not. We heard an earlier guest, Johnny, that was talking about the opiate epidemic, and you just heard from someone who has been going through that mess.
Absolutely, George, and it's a topic that I'm well aware of. I went to school to specialize in addiction studies and pharmacology, so it's a very, very sad thing that we're seeing. So I'm glad that people are becoming more aware of the epidemic.
Of all the things you investigate, and of course your book, The Cosmic Origins of Civilization, what has really shocked you the most?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I get asked that a lot because there's so many of them. But, you know, I spend a considerable amount of time with a very dear friend and teacher of mine, who's also a mutual friend of ours, Jordan Maxwell.
Yes.
And I go out in large road trips with him. And we go out to, you know, different strange places, and he gives me different strange stories. I think for me, you know, some of the most shocking things I've learned from him on how the world works and how it doesn't work and how, you know, that there's ETs underground in certain areas and all sorts of mysteries out there. But maybe it's the strange creatures that exist out there that if people knew they existed on the earth right now and they're cohabitating with us, maybe they might not sleep as well at night. Who knows?
That's true. How is Jordan doing these days?
He's doing great. You know, he's
getting up there and
always doing his research, you know.
He never stops.
He does it, man. And, you know, the thing about Jordan is that I think that everyone in this genre, all the research into secret societies, hidden symbolism, aliens, all that, we all owe an incredible thanks to him for all his work. And I know you've always been very supportive of him.
He's a good guy.
Definitely.
He's had his ups and downs, but he keeps fighting, doesn't he? Let's go to Joe in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joseph, go ahead.
Hi,
Joe.
I wanted to get your guest's impression of what I've been experiencing lately, not constantly, but intermittently. Just prior to going to sleep at night, I would see this matrix of symbols in front of me. I don't recognize the symbols. They were usually in a matrix of about 10 or 15 across by 20 down. They're polygons. And on each surface of each polygon, there's these strange symbols. Not only that, but they would move, and the symbols would morph. The whole polygon would shift positions. Several of these would do it simultaneously. They would twist. They would turn. The symbols themselves would change. Not only that, but it was accompanied by different sounds. The sounds itself is not musical. There were several tones that were blended together. And also, there were colors that associated with it, colors that are colorblind and can't see. Oh. And as these symbols would change positions and change shapes, and the symbols themselves would change within each surface of the polygon, the colors would change accordingly, and the sounds would change. And at some intuitive level, I'm thinking that what I'm perceiving here is an incredibly sophisticated, super complex alphabet. Perhaps it's a form of galactic communication, you know, referencing back to what you were talking about SETI before and looking for galactic communication for extraterrestrials. Maybe he's looking in the wrong place. Maybe it's not a technological thing, but it requires a living brain to perceive it. And then, of course, an unbelievable complex intellect to interpret it. I'd like to get your guest's idea on that, and if anybody else has ever reported seeing these things.
Okay.
Well, absolutely. I think when you see a manifestation in your room of a spirit or a ghost or any kind of what you're seeing in front of you, any sort of symbolism coming out, this is the neutrino light source brushing up against the fabrics of space-time. You got to remember that we live in a multifractal holographic universe, and everything is composed of this complex sacred geometry. And it gets so beautiful when we start to see how the universe is laid out before us, because we know that it resonates with sound when we go back into subatomic particles and wavelengths and resonance tones. I would say you are definitely being communicated through a higher source of consciousness, because if I understood you right, that you are colorblind, yet you are perceiving color, light, frequency, and geometrical shapes and patterns, most certainly you are being communicated. And I would agree with you that when it comes to extraterrestrial communication, from what I understand, it happens not only through a metamorphic and telepathic communication, but also through feeling, sometimes sound, in different ways. So I would take, if I were you, I would keep a journal of it, and I'd ask yourself very deeply what it means and explore it further.
Never come across anybody, Johnny, who has experienced the old hag syndrome?
Absolutely.
That's scary. Yeah. That's a weird feeling.
It is. And that's the thing, George, that you know this better than anybody. I mean, that there's people out there that are getting these experiences, and when they come to you and they tell you, they're very real, and they tell you that this is happening to me, and it's absolutely real. It's happening regularly.
Okay, back to the calls. Let's go to Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Whoa, two in a row, Barry.
I tell you what, George, you're exactly right. Two nights in a row. I just got off the phone with Cornelius. And anyway, George, talking about your first segment tonight, real quickly, but I got a question for Johnny. But I was addicted to, and my doctor helped me.
Oh, no.
Off with 5 milligrams of oxycodone for my low back pain, which I suffer from now. But anyway, went to 5 to 10 milligrams, and from 10 to 15 milligrams. And finally, he said, Barry, we're on first name basis. I've known him for over 20 years. And he said, I'm going to wean you off. And I swear, George, he cut me back. And sure enough,
well, he did it the right way. But go ahead with your question. We're almost at the break.
All right. Johnny, oh, man, I tell you what, you are the most refreshing voice that I've heard on Coast to Coast in a long time, and I've listened every night. Is Zahi Awas? You know the name. He swears that the pyramids of Egypt are only 4,500 years old. And we know, Göbekli Tepe, Jimmy Church talks about it as a fifth toes of yours, Jimmy. I mean, George. Anyway, why in the world don't we acknowledge that aliens have been here, because it's a huge jump?
They will not acknowledge it. Zahi Hawass will not acknowledge that anything other than Egyptians built those pyramids. And he's vehement about that, Johnny.
Yeah, you know, that is that's the thing with when you look at the pyramids, that the story that Egyptology and academia gives us is total nonsense. The idea that it was a tomb for Khufu or Khafre, and it's a Victorian age forgery that they're using to even say that. The whole thing, when I see the pyramid, I see an incredible technology there. And anyone who's ever visited the pyramid, all you have to do is you just go inside, you see the subterranean chamber, the queen's chamber, the king's chamber. You see how perfectly cut it is.
Oh, it's impossible to even build today. We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Johnny Enoch as we talk about the cosmic origins of civilization. Johnny will be with me in Vancouver, British Columbia on June 30th, Architects of the New Paradigm Conference. Full information at our events at coasttocoastam.com. Do you do many live events, Johnny?
I do. I've spoken at a few conferences and workshops. I really enjoy it. You know, the whole audience comes alive and they start interacting.
Yeah, that is really important, too. It helps you out. I do it a lot all over the country,
yes,
and we do some live stage shows. We got to get you at one of them. Geographically, where do you live?
Vancouver, Canada.
Okay, that's where you are. So that makes it easy there for you. We may get up back up there. We had a show up there a couple of years ago. Had a great time up there. Let's go to the phones.
Great. I hope you do come back.
Joe in Long Island, New York, east of the Rockies. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Johnny, fantastic discussion. A couple of questions. One, with your Egyptology, do you see any evidence of like a convergence of civilizations as you might have had, say, with the Alexandria Library, where there were supposedly books from, you know, any number of places? I'm wondering if there was multiple languages that could have been deciphered, not just one group of people in that area that predominated. And also, it was fascinating to hear what you had to say about Ireland. And what I experienced on the coast of Dingle was strange phenomena in one early evening with a group of people. I went to an Irish wedding, and we ended up there later in the week, and there were like almost like pockets of strange phenomena converging, like I would say it like a grid. Okay, we drive down to one beach, there's like 5 foot waves, like sunny. The next beach over, there's a squall, there were 25 foot waves, as an example. So it was just many things like this throughout the whole evening. So I'm wondering what that's all about, if there's like fairies doing this, or is it just like a haunted location or whatever, where these things converge into strange phenomena.
Yeah, you know, there's all sorts of stories like that that we find traditionally there, elementals, and, you know, you get all sorts of different mischievous spirits, and the locals will tell you just countless stories like that. So your experience is not uncommon. You know, you get that a lot. And I think there's something very magical about that place. You know, it seems to be localized to there and some of those areas. So maybe whether it's on ley lines or it's the fact that it's on an island, I don't know what it is, but I think that's a really great story. Going into your first question that you asked about Egypt and the civilizations that are there, it's actually quite interesting because some have called hieroglyphics the mother of all languages, written ones. And there's so many different meanings that we get for them outside of the Rosetta Stone, because there's only so much that the Greeks were able to get from the priests, because there's a whole hidden levels of secrets that they would have had outside of that. When you look at hieroglyphics, you can read them in any different direction. You know, depending on which way they're facing, that's the direction you read them in. So if you're into the temples and you're reading the reliefs, you go look into the left if you have a snake facing that way, or you look down. So that's very, very fascinating when we look at many of our languages today. As for where Egypt came from, you know, Stephen Mailer always said it best to me. He said, Egypt is like an onion. You know, you look at it today, we have the Islamic layer. You go back and you'll have, you know, your Coptic Christian layer, your Jewish layer. You'll have your Roman, your Greek layer, your Persian layer. And as you go back further and further past the dynastic Egyptians, we start going into the pre-dynastic Egyptians. And that's where things get really crazy, because in these cycles, everyone that came there, they wanted to become Egyptians. And when you look at all the oldest stuff that's in Egypt there, you don't find any writing or any hieroglyphics in the pyramids. You don't find it in the oldest and most impressive stuff, like the Assyrian and whatnot. And Stephen would always tell me that this perhaps meant that they were telepathic. I think that these civilizations, the most advanced ones, came down through northern India from up in the Arctic. And this when we go back into the Vedas and everything, they came down into the with the Aryan people, came down into the Indo-Gangetic plains of the Indo-Ganges, mixed with the Dravidian people, and then this sort of spread out with the mysteries down into Asia Minor, northern Africa, back from the Atlanteans and all that. So I think we have a very ancient story here where all this knowledge comes from.
With your work as a hypnotherapist, have you done some alien abduction cases too?
Absolutely, George. And when you do the work with people that have been ET contactees, the stuff that comes out of that is incredible. It is mind-blowing. You sit there in a chair, and somebody is relaying to you the cases of missing time. They might have fractions of the memories, but they're telling you what the insides of the ships look like. They're telling you what these beings said to them, what they felt, you know, messages that were given to them. The stuff is so beautiful that you just, you become emotional, and you almost want to cry when you hear it. It's so beautiful about our universe. Some of the most rewarding stuff.
I bet you would have loved to have handled the Barney and Betty Hill case.
Oh, my God. Absolutely.
That would have been a classic.
I'm a big fan of Dolores Cannon, too.
Yeah. God rest her soul.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Joshua in Sacramento, California. Hey, Josh, go ahead.
Yeah. So what's really boggling my mind and what I wanted to ask your guest about is it possible that, you know, we like to think that there's somebody in this world, some elite group of people that know about all this stuff and they're keeping it a secret from us, the truth, whatever it is. And then is it possible that there's actually nobody who has their finger on the truth and that the elite are basically just playing this game of trying to pretend like they know or doing the best they can, and that there really is nobody who actually, like, has all of it in a row, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I'm most certainly very fascinated by the idea of ancient secret societies and the mysteries and how far it goes back. I would say that, you know, there has been a lot of secrets and information that I've discovered when I've done my research and people I've talked to that have been kept from the public, and for good reason, too. It's been kept out of the public eye. I mean, look what happened to Jacques de Molay, the famous Knights Templar, on Friday the 13th, 1307, when he was burned at a stake and came to his demise for all the accusations that were thrown at the Templar Knights for what they had. There's been many people that have been persecuted for certain knowledge. And so, you know, you get that over and over and over again throughout the world. But yeah, I also believe, like, what the Tao says, what Lao Tzu or Lao Tzu taught, he said, the Tao that can be named or the name that can be named is not the nameless name. It's not the ineffable name. So I think our elites that we look at today, you know, our very wealthy banking families, all these groups, any of those that you can actually name or look at, I don't think those are our true elites. I think that there is a much higher order of things. And of course, there's great mysteries, and they're now coming out now. I mean, we're discovering so much in the information age.
Let's go to Paul in Calgary, Canada. Hey, Paul, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
How are you?
Great.
First time caller.
Good to have you with us. You're speaking to another Canadian, Johnny Enoch.
Your voice puts me to sleep every night. It's just so soothing. It's great.
Let's hope it doesn't put you to sleep when you're listening to me in the car.
Anyways, I wanted to know about the elongated skulls. Do you think that probably maybe could be inbreeding in the royal family?
You know, I do think that there's a connection to all the royal families. I think that there's a connection, especially we probably don't have time to get into different anthropological aspects of RHO negative blood and everything like that. But most certainly there is a very interesting connection there from what I found with different bloodlines. And there's most certainly when we see these elongated skull types, if some will go back and they'll say, do we have links to royal lineages even going into Egypt? Because if you're in the Cairo Museum, one of the things you'll see is there's depictions of Akhenaten. Akhenaten, the rebel pharaoh, or king, so to speak, sorry. He is depicted with his entire family as having elongated skulls. But actually, we know from looking at his actual bust over in the Berlin Museum, he had a regular-looking skull.
Looks reptilian, too, doesn't he?
He's what?
Does he look reptilian to you?
Yeah, well, in the depiction we see in the Cairo Museum, he's depicted as the universal man with the hips. He's got the hermaphrodite look, which comes from Hermes and Aphrodite mixed together. He's the all the different features on Earth. So we know from also looking at his, you know, you look at his son, Tutankhamun, the remains, has quite a regular skull or even on Amenhotep III, like his father. So why did he want to look like an elongated skull? It's because, in my opinion, I'm just going to throw it out there, I believe that these are subclasses of extraterrestrials that were very advanced on Earth, and they gave us a major genetic upgrade, and they were on this planet, and they were also part of the mysteries that were reseeding civilization. So that's what I believe.
Are they still here, or did they leave?
Oh, they're absolutely here. They are here in every sense of the word, and their symbolism goes way back. Actually, if I have a couple minutes to just throw this in there, one of the most interesting discoveries I made recently in the British Museum, because I spend a lot of time in museums across Europe, I love them. When I was in there in the Assyrian wing talking to the anthropologists, it was neat because there's a little honeybee on the wall. But also the winged gods, the extraterrestrials that were instructing us on Earth, the individuals on the wall. Have you ever seen, George, the depictions of those men with bags?
Bags?
Yeah, if you look around the world, in all sorts of different cultures, it doesn't matter whether we're going, Assyrians, Akkadians, Phoenician, Canaanites, Etruscans, Egyptians, wherever you go, we've seen these men with bags. It looks like they have a man bag, and they're holding like what looks like a seed in their hand.
Huh, no, so, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, Dagon, who's got the elongated head, who's going to all the different types of civilization after the cataclysms to reseed them, he's got a bag, and they say that what was in the bag was actually pollen, and what he's holding in his hand was the date palm. Now, here's a trippy thing for you. Those elongated skulls that were found over in Paracas in Peru,
yeah,
there's a grove of date palms there. There's all sorts of date palms, and the Inca have no idea what to do with the date palm. It's not part of their culture. This represents the spreading of pollen after the cataclysms, which is why all the Egyptian kings called themselves the beekeepers. That's why the headdress of the king looks like a beekeeper. These guys were reseeding civilization. The date palm is significant because that was used for beehives and still is used for that in the ancient world. And the interesting part about this is that this symbolism was so powerful, as these guys that were holding the mysteries, these elongated skulled guys that were spreading pollen, that even when Adam Weishaupt was starting the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, on May 1st, 1776, the original name for the Illuminati was going to be the Beekeepers. The great Christian king, Charlemagne, used the symbol of the bee. This is so deep, the mysteries, how far they go. It's just amazing and mind-blowing.
All right, let's go to Ed in Monte Vista, Colorado, first-time caller. Ed, welcome to the program.
Oh, man. I'm here.
Yes, you are. Go for it.
Hey.
Turn your radio. Turn your radio down, Eddie.
Okay, I'm going to shut it off. Hold on.
Okay, go ahead.
There we go. I have listened to your program for 15 years. I've never gotten in. I've called probably dozens of times, forget that. But right now, I have a real important question.
Okay. And we've got a minute left, so give it your best shot.
Okay. Johnny said he's never found evidence of a hell existing. My question is, where did the Hitlers go? Where did the Stalins go?
That's a great question. Where do the evil ones go, Johnny?
When you go over to the other side, you're going to review your life on a 360-degree life review. You're going to review everything, and you're going to say, could I have done that a little bit better? Could I have been more kind? Could I have been more loving? And you're going to be your own greatest judge. When we go over there, we start to assess our lives from that perspective, and that is a sort of a real disappointment to us. If you go through school and you cheat your exams, when you get out into the real world, and you're going to go fill out a job application and you can't finish a sentence, who's the one that just lost out? Is it the school or is it you? So life is a school, and the purpose of being here is to grow and evolve. So that's the beautiful part about this journey.
Johnny's website, his Twitter, his Facebook, his YouTube, we've got them all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And Johnny, I'll see you in about 10 days in Vancouver, British Columbia.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, you take care. Johnny Enoch, what a great guest. Great first-time guest, too, by the way. He did just a remarkable job. Great program in store for you tomorrow. So stick with us on Coast to Coast AM. Just leave your dial right where it is on your very favorite radio station. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Alex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.